Now today, we're going to cover 3 full chapters of Joshua. You're not in any big hurry, are you? No lunch plans? Chapters 15, 16, and 17. Because they cover the giving of the land on the west side of the Jordan River to the most important of the 12 tribes. First Judah, then Ephraim, but also to Manasseh. Now, in a more technical sense, the 2 tribes of most importance were Judah and Joseph. But Ephraim and Manasseh, for some divine reason, would take the place of the tribe of Joseph, or let's say represent the tribe of Joseph for a time. Now, the land on the west side of the Jordan was the promised land, nowhere else. The land on the east side of the Jordan River was not the promised land, but nonetheless, it was allotted to the Israelite tribes of Reuben, Gad, and about half of the clans that made up the tribe of Manasseh, because they asked for it, and Moses granted their request. Now, why do I say at the outset that Judah and Ephraim were the most important tribes? Because the deathbed blessing upon Joseph's sons, known to us commonly as the tribes of Israel, by Jacob, split the traditional firstborn blessing into 2 parts. One part of it went to Ephraim, the other part went to Judah. Now, we're not going to fully review the last few chapters of Genesis where this series of blessings occurred, but let me sum up what happened, because it has so much to do with redemption, salvation, with that process that God developed for mankind. It has every bit as much to do with it as does the advent of Messiah, Yeshua, Jesus the Christ. Now, the way the continuity of leadership, control, and wealth were passed down within ancient families, clans, tribes of Israel was by means of a ceremony and a formal legal act. And that act was called the firstborn blessing. This concept was not unique for Hebrews. It was fairly standard within most tribal societies. To a large degree, it remains so to this day. The concept of the firstborn blessing was powerful, and generally it wasn't alterable once it was made. It was also accepted as fully enforceable as any of the best contracts that the most expensive of today's attorneys could fashion. The firstborn blessing that was used among the Hebrews and defined in the Bible by divine ordinance consisted of 2 basic parts. The first part was what's called the double portion blessing. The second part, the transference of ruling authority. Now, the double portion part involved wealth and material blessing, while the transference of ruling dealt with inheritance of tribal leadership. The 2 basic parts of the firstborn blessing were invariably linked together, and the same person received both. So now the term firstborn, by definition, means firstborn male offspring. There is no such thing in the Bible as a female firstborn. But something strange and important happened early in Hebrew history when Jacob split the firstborn blessing he was bestowing on his sons into 2 basic parts. He assigned one part of it to Judah, the other part of it to the tribe of Ephraim. And Jacob transferred the leadership part of it to Judah, the double blessing part of it of wealth and material, that went to Ephraim. Now, that doesn't sound so difficult to comprehend, does it? But it gets a little more complicated than that, I'm afraid. In fact, even though the name Ephraim is used to describe the person who received Jacob's tribal wealth. In reality, it was Joseph who was the inheritor. Joseph was Ephraim's father. Now, some days or weeks before Jacob called all of his sons together to pronounce the firstborn blessing before he passed away, he called Joseph to come to his bedside and to bring with him his two Egyptian-born sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, Manasseh was Joseph's firstborn. And so when Joseph's father, Jacob, called his two grandsons to come forward so he could bless them, this was to be a different kind of blessing, Joseph was shocked when his father crossed his arms and he put his right hand on Ephraim's head, his left hand on Manasseh's head. The right hand is the greater hand. It's symbolic of the hand that bestows greatest blessing and authority. Thus, when we read that Yeshua sits at the Father's right hand in heaven, it's because the one who sits to the right of the king or the master is the most favored. Joseph even tried to correct his father, probably because he thought he was old and firm and nearly blind, that Jacob was merely making an unintentional error by placing the hand of greatest blessing on the younger of Joseph's two children. But Jacob abruptly told Joseph that he knew full well what he was doing. He was doing it on purpose. And in this blessing of his grandchildren, Jacob not only bestowed greater status upon Ephraim, who was the younger of his two grandboys, he also adopted both of those grandchildren away from Joseph. He changed the status of his grandchildren to sons. And in doing so, he displaced Joseph as a tribal progenitor in name and replaced him with Joseph's two sons, who were now legally, as weird as it gets, Joseph's brothers. See that? His two sons became his brothers, legally. Now, while to us, this sounds like some kind of a weird, archaic punishment upon Joseph, in fact, it was all meant as a blessing for him. Because in an instant, Joseph became not one, but two tribes. The tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. Joseph doubled. Not only that, but the scriptures explain that these two new tribes were going to go forward in the name of, or as representative of, Joseph. So effectively, Ephraim and Manasseh would be as placeholders in history of Joseph's tribe until some undefined time far into the future when Joseph's tribal name would rise up again and take preeminence back from his two sons, or two brothers. But there was yet another effect of these ceremonies. Joseph, by means of Ephraim, was receiving the double portion part of the firstborn blessing. This would happen a few days or months later when Jacob formally pronounced the firstborn blessing when all of his sons were present, his natural-born sons were present. By Joseph becoming two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, this would be a double portion. When Joseph's two tribes entered the promised land, they would each get their own territory. They would each establish their own wealth. And this would all eventually be ascribed to Joseph. So the double portion became double in the most literal possible way. since Ephraim was also pronounced as the firstborn by Jacob. Now this left poor Manasseh, the oldest child of Joseph, to just lose his traditional place of honor as the actual firstborn, then it was Ephraim's name who became the greater of those two brothers. And so when the Bible speaks in shorthand, as it often does, expecting the reader to know that it's just abbreviating, it will say Ephraim carries the rod of authority or the staff of authority for the tribe of Joseph. And then it says practically nothing about Manasseh. So what we have to keep in the back of our minds when we're studying especially the Old Testament, but also many sections of the New Testament, is that Ephraim is operating under the authority of the tribe of Joseph. And while Manasseh has become lesser in status than his younger brother Ephraim, the Lord has not forgotten about Manasseh. This especially comes back around in the tribal listings that we find in the book of Revelation that pertains to the end times and even thereafter. So we have come full circle. Judah was given the leadership of Israel. Ephraim, in the name of his father Joseph, was given the double portion. This makes them the two most important tribes of Israel. And so they are the first to receive the blessing of land inheritance inside the promised land. And that is the subject of Joshua chapters 15, 16, and 17. But now let me show you one more interesting thing. On the east side of the Jordan River, Manasseh was one of three tribes who took land possession there. What we're about to see inside these next few chapters of Joshua is that Manasseh would also get another portion of land inside the promised land. Manasseh would actually wind up, in other words, the brother that didn't get his firstborn inheritance like he should have, Manasseh would actually wind up with two portions of land. This fulfilled God's promise to Jacob, who had apparently followed God's divine instruction for him to elevate Ephraim to firstborn status above the older Manasseh, of still giving mighty blessings, God promised, at a later date to Manasseh to make up for this undeserved removal of his firstborn rights. In Genesis 48:18, we read this. Joseph said to his father, "Don't do it that way, my father. This is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head." But his father refused. And he said, "I know that, my son. I know it. He too will become a people. He too will become great. Nevertheless, his younger brother will be greater than he, and his descendants will grow into many nations." In a way only God can manufacture, Manasseh also received essentially a double portion. He received one portion of land inheritance on the east side of the Jordan and a second one on the west side of the Jordan. And as we look back in history, we can now better understand at least one purpose for God permitting 2.5 of Israel's tribes to settle on land outside of the promised land. Listen, nothing in this world happens accidentally. And as we get ready to read Joshua 15 through 17, let's review a little bit what we've learned from Joshua chapter 14. The compiler of the book of Joshua gives us two important themes regarding the distribution of the land of Canaan. First, he shows us that the promises and the prophecies of the Torah to the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, followed precisely the pattern the Lord said it would. The right person distributed the land, and the right persons received the land. The excluded persons were sent to their own land, and the priests and their Levite tribe were given no land inheritance or even any land responsibilities. Even the issue of expanding and contracting, of the expanding contracting number of Israelite tribes is re-explained. And it is made clear that this is so God can bring about his plan for Israel. We're also reminded that the land inheritance each tribe would receive was for the good of the people. It was the result of a promise of Jehovah, not because some earthly king had arbitrarily given away land tracts to some aristocrats or to some political partners for his own ultimate benefit. Now, the second theme of the compiler of Joshua is to demonstrate just why it was that Judah had received that first promised land inheritance, even though the first allotment was not actually Judah, but only the clan of Caleb, who was just one of the many clans that together formed the tribe of Judah. This also fulfilled a promise, but it also demonstrated something that many modern Jews prefer to forget. The Lord gave a section of the promised land to a person of foreign origin. Caleb was of the line of Kenaz, a line that emitted from Esau. Caleb had been brought into the tribe of Judah for sure, and we know this from the book of Numbers as we hear the story of the 12 spies who go out to scout out the land of Canaan for Moses. But we see that the issue of receiving an inheritance from the God of Israel was much less about family and genealogy than it was about obedience to him, obedience to God. Caleb, was the perfect example of those who had received the land from God, but he would also be a reminder to the future generations of Israelites who would lose the land because they followed the ways of King Solomon. King Solomon did not follow God's Torah. He instead had great lust for personal wealth and power, and so he led the life of an internationalist. He went to foreign lands. He brought home foreign wives. He permitted foreign ways. He permitted foreign gods to be brought into Israel. This behavior lit the pathway to Israel's future destruction due to their rebellion against God. Well, it would be best if we read chapters 15, 16, and 17 in one sitting, but I don't think he could stand it. I think you'll enjoy it a lot more if we don't. And the reason is it just contains a very long list of cities and boundaries, frankly, most of which aren't even identifiable anymore. So let's just read chapter 15. Then we'll talk about it for a few minutes, and then we'll read 16 and 17 together. So open up your Bibles to Joshua chapter 15. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's on page 257. Joshua chapter 15. The territory chosen by Lot for the tribe of the descendants of Judah, according to their families, extended to the border of Edom in the Sin Desert and toward the Negev in the far south. Now, the southern border began at the far shore of the Dead Sea from the bay facing southward and went out south of the Scorpion Ascent, passed toward Zin, went up south of Kadesh Barnea, passed Hetzron, went up toward Adar, turned towards Karka, and passed towards Atzmon, and went out of the Wadi of Egypt with the border ending at the sea. This will be your southern border. The eastern border was the Dead Sea to where the Jordan entered it. The northern border began at the Bay of the Sea at the end of the Jordan, and then the border went up to Bet Hogla, passed north of Bet Araba, and then the border went up to the stone of Bohan, the son of Reuben. Then the border went up to Debir from the Achor Valley, the northward-facing Gilgal, that is across from Maaleh Arumim, which is on the south side of the Wadi. Next, the border passed to the Ein Shemesh Spring and went out at Ein Rogel. Then the border went up to Ben Hinnom Valley, to the south of the Yavusi, that is Jerusalem. The border continued up to the top of the hill in front of the Hinnom Valley on the west, which is also the northernmost end of the Rephaim Valley. And from this hilltop, the border was drawn to the source of the Neftuach Spring and continued out into the cities of Mount Ephron. And next, the border was drawn to Baalah, that is Kiryat Yarim. And then the border turned from Baal westward to Mount Seir, past the spur of Mount Yarim, also called Kasalon, on the north, and went down to Bet Shemesh, and past Timnah. Next, the border went out towards the side of Echron, northward. And finally, the border was drawn to Shichron, and passed Mount Baalah, and went out to Yavni'el, with the border ending at the sea. And as for the west border, the Great Sea was its border. These were the borders of the territory of the descendants of Judah by clans. To Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, he gave a portion with the descendants of Judah as Adonai had ordered Joshua, namely Kiryat Arba. Arba was the father of Anak, also called Hebron. Caleb expelled from there three descendants of Anak, Sheshai, Achman, and Talmai, children of Anak. And from there he went up to fight the inhabitants of Debir. Now Debir was formerly called Kiryat Sefer. And Caleb said, to whoever overpowers Kiryat Sefer and captures it, I will give my daughter Aksa as his wife. Otniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's brother, captured it. So he gave him Aksa, his daughter, as his wife. And after becoming his wife, she persuaded him to ask her father to give them a field, which she got offered. And when she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, what do you want? And she said to him, give me a blessing. Since you gave me land in the Negev, also give me sources of water. So Caleb gave her the upper springs and the lower springs. This is the inheritance of the tribe of the descendants of Judah by clans. The cities as the outer part of the tribe of Judah towards the border with Edom in the south were Kabzeel, Eder, Yagur, Kina, Dimona, Adaa, Kadesh, Hatzor, Yit'an, Zif, Telem, Belot, Hatzor, Karta, Kriot, Hetzron, Amam, Shma, Molada, Hatzar Kada, Beshmon, Beit Pelet, Hatzar Shual, Beer Sheba, Bitzo Ya, Baala, Iyim, Etzem, El Totad, Kesil, Khorma, Ziklag, Madmana, Sasana, Levot, Shilkim, Ain and Rimon, 29 cities in all, together with their villages. In the Shephelah, Eshtaol, Zorah, Ashna, Zanoch, Ein Ganim, Tapuach, Inam, Yarmuth, Adulam, Soko, Azekah, Sharim, Adityaim, Gederah, and Gedertayim, 14 cities together with their villages. Tznan, Hadashah, Migdal, Gad, Dilan, Mitzpeh, Yokti'el, Lachish, Boskat Eglon, Kabon, Lachmas, Kitlish, Gerot, Beit Dagon, Naama, and Makeda, 16 cities together with their villages. Libna, Eter, Ashan, Yiftach, Azna, Lativ, Kela, Ashtiv, and Mershah, 9 cities together with their villages. Ekron with its 7 villages, from Ekron to the sea, all those near Ashdod with their villages. Ashdod with its towns and villages, Gaza, with its towns and villages, to the Wadi of Egypt with the Great Sea as its border. In the hills, Shamir, Yatir, Soko, Dana, Kiryat Sana, Anav, Eshtmo, Anim, Goshen, Holon, and Gilo, 11 cities together with their villages. Arab, Duma, Eshan, Yanum, Beit Tapuach, Afek, really Afekha, but Humta, Kiryat Arba, Sior, 9 cities together with their villages, Meon, Carmel, Zif, Utah, Yisrael, Yokdeam, Zanoah, Cain, Giva and Timnah, 10 cities together with their villages, Halkul, Beitzur, Gdor, Marot, Beit Anot, Elkon, 6 cities together with their villages, Kiryat Baal, that is Kiryat Yarim, and Rabbah, 2 cities together with their villages, and in the desert, Beit Erabah, Medin, Shekna, Nivshan, Ir Hamalech, and Ein Gedi, 6 cities together with their villages. As for the Yavusi, that's the Jebusites who lived in Jerusalem, the descendants of Judah could not drive them out. So the Jebusites lived with the descendants of Judah in Jerusalem to this day. Okay, that's a lot of cities. Yeah, I need a drink. Water. Chapter 15 is all about the land distribution to Judah, okay? Now, Caleb, tribe of Judah, had already received some land. Now, the whole of the land that Judah was going to receive is explained. Now, it's not important for us to examine every city and boundary for one reason. I don't think we'd remember it. A map's a lot better way to demonstrate what was officially given to Judah. Now, Judah was to be a pretty large territory because it was a pretty large tribe. And the purpose of the second round of lots that was supervised by Eleazar the high priest and by Joshua was to match up the already decided relative location of each tribe in the land. That was decided by lots that Moses officiated over some years earlier. It was to match up now with the population size of each tribe. Now, roughly speaking, the territory of Judah extended from the north of the Dead Sea over to the Mediterranean, and on the south along the shore of the Dead Sea and continuing towards Kadesh Barnea and west to the Wadi El Arish, also called the Wadi of Egypt. Now, because the 9.5 tribes' territories were contiguous, that is, where one ended, the next one began, and they bumped up against one another, we're going to find some of the boundary lines repeated in later chapters as pertaining to other tribal territories. For instance, the northern boundary for Judah was also the southern boundary of Benjamin, because the two lay right next to each other. So verse 12 is rather interesting if we understand what it's inferring. It says that the Great Sea is Judah's westernmost boundary. Now, the thing we know from earlier chapters is that Joshua took none of the coastal areas of Canaan, and that the land given to Judah then essentially included parts of Philistia and their ally, the Philistines' ally to the south, the Gerishites. See, here's the thing to understand. The giving of the land was not just a gift of territory. It was also the assigning of a responsibility to finish conquering the territory. They didn't like that part. Okay? Much of Judah was already conquered. Other parts of it, like the coast, all along the coast, those were still in the hands of the enemy. All right? So it fell to the members of Judah's tribe to make war until that job was done. Now, later on in Joshua, we're going to find that as it begins to sink into the minds of these other tribes, just what it is they're signing up for when they accept their land inheritance, some of them refused to take it. They said, no, thank you, to Joshua and to God. So Joshua had to actually rally some muscle and support to get these tribes to agree to go ahead and take their own land inheritances. Now, this, of course, harkens back to the exact same attitude that was displayed by 10 of those 12 scouts that had been sent out by Moses from Kadesh to reconnoiter the promised land, and they all came back with a resounding, thanks but no thanks. Only Caleb, the tribe of Judah, and Joshua, tribe of Ephraim, interestingly, said that Israel should believe God and just go take the land. Thus, Israel was sent away by God to wander in the wilderness until that generation completely died off. And notice that because history is circular, it repeats itself. Caleb of the tribe of Judah, Joshua of the tribe of Ephraim, immediately took their land inheritances when it was offered to them, while the others balked at the idea. So in verse 13 now, we get back to the history of Caleb, and his land inheritance. And we're told that the area he was given had not been fully conquered. But Caleb actually asked for this unconquered area, a sign of great courage, merit, and trust in God. Further, the Lord told Joshua that he was to give this to Caleb, so it was a done deal. The area was Hebron, and it was under the control of the Anakites. The Anakites was a race of giant, fierce warriors. Goliath was an Anakite. And we were told that in time, after Joshua's death actually, Caleb's clan was going to drive out the three ruling clans of the Anakites, Sheshai, Achman, and Talmai. But apparently, Caleb's clan had considerably more trouble conquering the area called Debir, so much so that he decided the best course of action was to seek a volunteer leader to try to take Debir, and to whom he would award his daughter, Achsah, as a wife if this leader was successful in taking that land. Now please notice that the complete Jewish Bible renders this doctor's name, daughter's name in verse 4 as Adar, in verse 16, then Achsah in verse 17. I don't know why. And the Hebrew is the same for both passages. Perhaps it's just a simple error or there's something more to this. I've never figured out. I want to pause for a second and point out that we're reading a lot of double names for places. Debir and Kiryat Sefer, for instance. Now, the reasoning behind this is pretty simple. Okay, one name is the name it was called by the Canaanites. The other name is the name the Hebrews gave to it. Pretty simple. Even today, what is Jerusalem known by among the Arabs? Al-Quds. Al-Quds. The Hebrews call it Yerushalayim. Both are fully accepted. If you're over there talking to an Arab, don't talk about Jerusalem. Talk about Al-Quds. See, the Middle East is an ancient place. Places have changed hands many times. Languages have shifted and changed. Cultures live side by side, each within the framework of their own unique historical culture and traditions and perspectives. A significant number of these ancient place names still, to this day, go by double names over there. So you got to kind of get used to that when you go over there and hang out at all. You're going to hear the same place called by two, even three names. Well, back to Caleb offering his daughter to the man who would take the city of Debir from the enemy. A fellow named Otniel managed to do it. So he received Caleb's daughter. Now, what is kind of interesting is that Otniel was actually Caleb's younger brother. So what we have here is that Otniel was Achsah's uncle. We have a niece being given to her uncle as a bride. Now, this was legal, and it was done often in the Bible era. It also served to keep power within a given clan. It's all in the family. Remember, what we tend to think mainly of the 12 tribes of Israel when dealing with the Bible is at the tribal level. But it was individual clans within each tribe where the real power lay. This reality is played out a little bit for us in the following verse when right after the marriage, Achsah approaches her father, Caleb, and asks him for a field. Of course, who do you suppose sent her in there to do that? That new husband of hers, his younger brother. Apparently, Caleb had given Achsah some land in her bride's dowry, and this land was in the Negev. Now, if you've ever been to Israel, the Negev is not very good land. It's most of it is just totally arid. And now Aksa came back to her father and said, okay, I'll take the land. We're going to need a little water there too, you know. So he gave her some springs to go with the land. Now this chapter finishes up by dividing the land of Judah into four districts that are really climate and fertility regions. The Southland, the Negev, the lowlands, the Shephelah, the mountains, and the Judean desert. Now, the Negev is kind of a transition zone. It transitioned from the fertile regions of the Shephelah and the mountains into desert. So the Negev could grow crops in some areas, be marginal pasture lands in other areas, but then as it neared the desert, the soil just became totally dry and unusable. The Shephelah transitioned from the mountains over in the west as you head, over in the east side of the land towards the west as it went down towards the Mediterranean coast. It had excellent growing conditions, had very rich soil. It was prime farming grounds. The mountains were wonderful for grazing, for pasture. And there were plateaus. Those plateaus could generally support vineyards and orchards. But the Judean desert was a wasteland. It had no vegetation or water. Now, we're not going to study these long lists of cities and villages. So I just want you to understand that there is a basis for grouping these cities and villages as it was laid out. These various villages within a grouping were cooperative. And to some degree, they depended on one another. Okay. Geography always plays a role, just as it has always in determining where you can even have a village or a town, where you can't. I mean, think about here. Before the era of canals and massive land-moving machinery, here in Florida, towns were built along natural waterways or on higher ground above the swampy areas. You might have a few square miles of high ground suitable for crops, livestock, and the construction of stores and dwellings separated from the next suitable area by many miles of more swamps. So towns and villages are clustered in areas of suitable ground and where one might have to go some distance before another ideal area is found. Transportation between these islands of civilization were very difficult. Even here in Florida 50 years ago, but 3,000 years ago? So when a cluster of villages is on a large enough parcel, then commerce and common defense is more possible, and working together, this group of villages can become more or less self-sufficient. That's the reason we find these groupings of villages listed in Joshua chapter 15. These are clusters of villages separated from the other clusters of villages by geography, whether that geography is miles of parched desert, high mountains with few passes, maybe a big lake, perhaps a wide river. These village clusters depended on one another. They acted together as a rather complete local economy. There was usually one main city in a cluster with some larger towns and then some smaller villages. Certain clans tended to prefer certain areas. Perhaps one clan was renowned for tradecraft, another for expert winemaking, others for shepherding. It was better for everybody in a clan if they were the dominant clan in a cluster of villages located in a district that suited their particular needs and skill, because there was less conflict, more cooperation. There was intermarriage between families in a clan. And by the way, that was the desire that would happen. It was easier to accommodate and control everything, and the all-important power of the clan then would retain the best environment to grow with the fewest impediments and outside influences. That's tribalism. That's how it operates. The final verse of chapter 15 makes it clear that whenever the compiler of Joshua lived, it was before the time of King David, because he says that the Jebusites, who lived in Jebus, still controlled it. Jebus is really Jerusalem, all right? And the tribe of Judah didn't have any luck in taking it out. So Jerusalem was not in Israel's hands at the time the compiler put all this together. So it was before King David. All right, let's move on to chapter 16 and 17. They're not so long. Chapter 16 starts at page 259 if you have a complete Jewish Bible. The border of the territory chosen by lot for the descendants of Joseph, here his name pops up, Joseph, began from the Jordan at Jericho. At the spring of Jericho on the east, it went up from Jericho through the hills and desert to Beit El, went out from Beit El to Luz, passed on to the border with the Arki to Atarot, and went down westward to the border with the Yafleti, to the border of Lower Beit Horon, on to Gezer and ending at the sea. So the descendants of Joseph, Manasseh and Ephraim, took the inheritance. The border of the descendants of Ephraim, according to their families, was as follows. The eastern border of their inheritance began at Atarot Adar and went to Upper Beit Horon. Then the border extended westward with Mikmatat on the north. Next, the border turned eastward to Ta'anat Shiloh and passed by it to the east of Yanocha. Then it went down from Yanocha to Atarot, went to Nara, extended to Yericho, and ended at the Yarden, the Jordan. From Tepuach, the border went westward to Wadi Kana and ended at the sea. This is the inheritance of the tribe of the descendants of Ephraim, according to their families, together with the city set aside for the descendants of Ephraim inside the territory to have been inherited by the descendants of Manasseh, all the cities with their villages. They did not drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer. So the Canaanites lived together with Ephraim to this day, having become slaves to do the heavy work. On to chapter 17. This was the territory chosen by Lot for the tribe of Manasseh, for he was the firstborn of Joseph. As for Machir, the firstborn of Manasseh, the father of Gilad, because he was a warrior, he got Gilad and Bashan. So the lot was drawn for the other descendants of Manasseh according to their families, for the descendants of Aviezer, Helek, Asriel, Shechem, Hefer, and Shemidah. These were the male descendants of Manasseh according to their families. But Zolofchad, the son of Hefer, the son of Gilad, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, had no sons, only daughters. These are the names of his daughters: Machla, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah. And they approached Eleazar the priest, Joshua the son of Nun, and the leaders, and they said, "Adonai ordered Moses to give us an inheritance together with our kinsmen. Therefore, in keeping with Adonai's order, he gave them an inheritance together with the kinsmen of their father. Thus, 10 parts fell to Manasseh in addition to the land of Gilead and Bashan beyond the Jordan, because the daughters of Manasseh had an inheritance along with his descendants. But the land of Gilead belonged to the rest of the descendants of Manasseh. The border of Manasseh began at Asher and went to Mikmatat, which is across from Shechem. Next, the border went along to the right, to the people of Ein Tepuach. And the land of Tepuach belonged to Manasseh, but Tepuach on the border of Manasseh belonged to the descendants of Ephraim. The border descended to Wadi Kana, south of the Wadi, by cities which belonged to Ephraim along the cities of Manasseh, but the border with Manasseh was on the north side of the Wadi. It ended at the sea. Southward, it was Ephraim's. Northward, it was Manasseh's. And the sea was its border, while to the north they extended to Asher, and to the east of Issachar. In Asher and Issachar, Manasseh had Beit Shan and its villages, Yivleam and its villages, and the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, of Ein Dor and its villages, of Taanach and its villages, and of Megiddo and its villages, three districts in all. But the descendants of Manasseh could not drive out the inhabitants of those cities. The Canaanites wanted to stay in that land. After the people of Israel had become strong, they made the Canaanites do heavy labor, but they didn't completely drive them out. Then the descendants of Joseph spoke to Joshua, and they said, "Why have you given me only one lot and only one portion to inherit? After all, I'm a great people, since Adonai has blessed me so." And Joshua answered them, "Well, if you're a great people, go up to the forest and clear land for yourself there in the territory of the Perizzites and the Rephaim, since the hills of Ephraim don't give you enough space." And the descendants of Joseph replied, "The hills won't be enough for us. And all the Canaanites living in the valleys have iron chariots, both those in Beit Shan and its villages and those in the Jezreel Valley." Then Joshua said to the house of Joseph, to both Ephraim and Manasseh, "You are a great people with much power. You will not have only one lot, but the hills will be yours. Although it is a forest, you will clear it. And the resulting open land will be yours. You will drive out the Canaanites, even though they have iron chariots and they are strong." Well, Judah has its land. So now it's time for the Joseph tribe to get theirs. Notice that in chapter 16, verse 1, it says that the lot was drawn for who? The descendants of Joseph. In other words, only one lot was drawn for Ephraim and Manasseh together, not one for each of them. And it was done in the name of their father, Joseph. This is why I went through this long explanation at the beginning of today's lesson. The Joseph tribe now consisted of the separate tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, with Ephraim being the dominant tribe. So the boundary description we get to start this chapter is of the entire area that Ephraim and Manasseh would hold when you take it together. So even though from one perspective, Ephraim and Manasseh held independent, autonomous tribal areas, from another viewpoint, they were looked upon as a single entity, the tribe of Joseph. This land allotment for the Joseph tribe did not have a common border with Judah. It represented the northernmost land of the land of Canaan that was conquered by Joshua. The land in between Judah's land and those two tribes who formed the Joseph tribe would eventually be given to other and smaller tribes of Israel. It would change. The border to the east was the Jordan River. The border to the west was the Mediterranean Sea. But just as it was for Judah, none of the coastline of the land given to them had been conquered. So the duty to take it fell to Ephraim and Manasseh. It's best to just see the area on a map. You see the map up here, to understand their territory rather than try to describe it all in words. Well, after the first five verses have defined the total territory given to the Joseph tribe, now it's divided between Ephraim and Manasseh, with Ephraim getting his first because of his preeminence as having been given firstborn rights. The most pertinent information beyond the giving of territorial boundaries is that in the area of Gezer, the Ephraimites were unable to drive the Canaanites out who lived there. But we're going to find out in later books that Ephraim did manage to subjugate them. And they used them basically as serfs. This is a theme we're going to find constantly playing out regarding the promised land. The tribes accept their land inheritance. They work for a bit trying to drive out the Canaanites. But as often as not, they can't, or they find a reason not to. So they settle for a compromise. For the Lord God, however, compromise is a human concept. It's a human concept. There's no compromise in heaven. Compromise is not a middle ground between doing what is wrong and doing what is right. Nor is it some type of marginally acceptable gray area that lay between obedience and disobedience. Compromising God's principles and instructions, there's a word for that in the Bible. It's sin. Sin has long-ranging consequences that might not be totally apparent for decades, maybe even centuries. Well, very quickly, the text moves on to the allotment of land for the other Joseph tribe, Manasseh. And by the way, you'll note I've spelled Manasseh a couple of different ways. I mean, look, all we're doing is we're attempting to sound out Hebrew words into English. The point is to form a series of alphabet characters that can at least get as close to the way it sounds in the original tongue, which frankly, most people can't say anyway. Therefore, there is no one correct spelling for most Hebrew words that are being pronounced using English grammar rules. Anyway, it's interesting that in this verse we are reminded that Manasseh was the firstborn of Joseph. And this bit of text just emphasizes the very unusual nature and the order of the land allotment. Ephraim first, then Manasseh. I think that just as we struggle in our time so mightily with how to apply the law of Moses in our lives, taking into account the coming of our Savior and all that that means, plus adding in the realities of how enormously different a modern Western culture is from an ancient Hebrew culture, we should be able to some degree appreciate how hard it was for the Hebrews to apply and accept some of these giant curveballs God threw at them from time to time. I mean, the Ephraim and Manasseh situation, where the secondborn is given firstborn rights, must have chafed at them. I mean, this was a sacred thing, this firstborn right business. And how are they to apply this? I mean, did Ephraim get all the rights of the firstborn? Or did Manasseh just get some? I mean, how literally and to what length were they to apply Jacob's cross-handed blessing to the hierarchy of their tribal leadership and the rights of property possession? These were questions that were in their minds all the time. However, I also think that while virtually every Bible scholar and commentator I've ever read looks at this statement about Manasseh as only a statement that both acknowledges and apologizes for having the natural firstborn son, Manasseh, get his land allotment only after the natural secondborn son, Ephraim, got his, which is, by the way, a nearly unthinkable breach of inheritance protocol in that era. It's obvious to me that it's also meant to explain just why it is that only Manasseh wound up with two separate and distinct territories when everybody else just got one. After all, that is a question that certainly would have been asked. Think about it. How come he got two and I got one? That's what the other tribal leaders would be thinking. For centuries to come, you think they thought it fair? No way. All one has to do is look at a map. Look at the size of these territories. All you have to do is look at the map and see that not only did Manasseh get one territory on the east side of the Jordan, another separate and distinct territory on the other side of the Jordan, on the west, but both these territories were large in relation to what the other tribes received. I see that in God's amazing provision, Manasseh still received his double portion blessing. He still got it that a firstborn is normally entitled to. Even though the Lord, for his own sovereign reasons, supernaturally instructed Jacob to switch the birthrights of Ephraim and Manasseh. We'll continue on with this chapter and look at another biblical oddity it contains next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.